This is Marcia Ripp and Chuck Coffey for National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Number 2, August 28, 1968, interviewing Mr. Hyman Diamond. All right. Mr. Diamond, would you please tell us your birthday?
Well, my birthday is August the 4th, 1901. I was born in Lithuania, and I don't think they keep any records or anything, so I think the August the 4th was derived from the Jewish, the Hebrew date on which I was born, and I don't know what the accurate date is, but that's the date I use.
When did you come to America?
It must have been at the end of 1905, and now we went through. See, I was born in Zezmer, Z-E-Z-M-E-R, Lithuania. And my father had been drafted. They called it the Brezhiv in Europe. He had been drafted earlier, and he had served in the Russian army 3 years and 8 months. So that when the Japanese war broke out, he wanted no part of it, and he took off for the United States, and I had a sister who was born a year and a half after Lena. She's now deceased, and he took off for the United States, and my mother, my sister, and I went to live in Dunkirk, Latvia, with my grandmother and my two aunts. My father and my uncle had gone to the United States. And in Dunkirk, we went through the 1905 revolution. Apparently, that's the reason I think we came here towards the end of 1905. Of course, Latvia, you know, was like it is today. It regarded itself as a separate people. So there were revolutionaries in Latvia, and one of the early experiences that I can remember that we were awakened one night at dawn sometime, and it was in winter. The snow was on the ground, and they took us out, the whole town, a little town, a shtetl. They took us out on a field, and apparently what they were doing was executing some of the revolutionaries, because we could hear the volleys, and the mothers, of course, thought that they were shooting at the people, and they'd fall over and cover the children. My mother told me that. That I don't remember, but I think I can remember the volleys. Now, we came here after that. What happened was the Cossacks came into town, and everybody was frightened. And as a matter of fact, we left the town, most of the town left. And when they came back, there were my mother says, some 19 homes, and they were, you know, like log cabins, were destroyed, burned down. I don't know why, but that's the way they... Czarist people operated. So we came here, and why my father came to Pittsburgh, I don't know. He was in the wholesale fruit business, and we came here to, he had a store at 16th Street on Penn Avenue, and we lived upstairs from the store temporarily. At that time, there were no filters in the water, and I had typhoid fever for 7 weeks. That part I can remember. After that, we moved to Bedford Avenue. There were a series of flats at Bedford Avenue across from... I don't know whether it's still there, but the McKelvey School. And the McKelvey School wasn't there when we lived there. What was there was a roller rink and a big field, and down the street was a reservoir for drinking and a sort of a park, and we lived there for a number of years, and my sisters were born there, two more sisters were born there. When we moved to Bedford Avenue, I'll get some of these things. I took out some of these things for you. I'll tell you, I want to show you, at this point, I'd like to show you a photograph of mine that was taken while we were still in Europe. Lithuania, do you want to see it?
Yes, we're always happy to see them.
All right. Let's go in the other room.
Ah, no, then we better wait and see it afterwards, because we'll continue the tape and then see it when the tape's
all
finished.
Right.
How's
you
that?
See it, but
after the tape is finished.
It's a rather interesting photograph.
All right, we'll see it when we've finished our tape.
Okay.
Is a photograph going to lead you to tell us something?
Well, not much. I guess, I was a poor. My mother didn't count girls. She said she had a son and three other children. And she apparently this photograph was taken because my mother doted on me, you know. So it's an interesting photograph. I just thought.
Well, we'll want to see it, but I think we'll wait.
What I'm getting at is if it's going to lead in line with what you want to say, let's look at now and have you continue your conversation. If it's not.
I don't know that whether you'll want to ask a question about it or anything, so I thought maybe you might want to look at it and
later.
See. You can look at it later if you want to.
From Bedford Avenue, how long did you stay there? Do you remember?
Oh, we stayed there 3 or 4 years anyway. Flat was about a half a mile or so from where the arena is now.
Oh, yes.
And I want to, shall I continue then?
Oh, yes.
Well, when we moved to Bedford Avenue, I went to, that's when I started school, at the Moorhead School. Now, I was lucky, because at that time, the educational system hadn't developed the perfection that it has now of being able to tell by giving a six-year-old kid an IQ test what he's going to do all the rest of his life. They didn't give IQ tests. Now, as it happened, I couldn't speak the language. I could only speak Yiddish. I could still speak Yiddish. And if they didn't give IQ tests in Yiddish, so I'd have made zero on my IQ test, and then they'd have told me low intelligence, and the only thing I could hope for was for some menial job. So I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was of low intelligence. And I went to school, and ultimately, I guess in a second, they didn't have grades. They had rooms. We wrote on a slate. But when I was in maybe room 2 or 3, I finally learned the language, so I knew what the teacher was talking about. And so I went to Moorhead School for, I think, till I was in the sixth grade. It was, I think, room number 6. Then we moved to Lombard Street, which is just above Dinwiddie Street. And I had to change schools. And at that time, the nearest school, the so-called neighborhood school, was the Miller School. But there was no room for us at the Miller School, so they told us we had to go to the Grant School. The Grant School was where the Copper's Building is now, right at the foot of 7th Avenue. post office there then. What there was a lot of, I don't know, there were a number of Italian stores. The Italians lived in that area. And what they were doing was integrating the Jewish children with the Italian children. And now we had to take a streetcar or get down there some other way. The community was Jewish people, immigrants, and to them the school and the school authorities were important people, and they didn't argue about me not going to a neighborhood school. I think I was in what was then 6A, they changed over by that mm-hmm. time. And I stayed there until I think went through 8B, maybe 8A. And by the time I got to 8A, or 8B, they had room in the Miller School, so they transferred us to the Miller School. And then, of course, after that, I didn't know that I was of low intelligence, so I went to high school. You know, those immigrants regarded education as very important. And when I used to get bad grades, my father used to holler. And when I told him that the other boys got bad grades, he'd... the roof would fall in. He'd say, was half mir, was under the tuin. So I went on to high school, Fifth Avenue High School. And we lived on Lombard Street until I went into Fifth Avenue High School in 1916. We lived on Lombard Street until the middle of 1917, and then I transferred over to Peabody High School. For a while, I had to take a streetcar from East Liberty. We moved to East Liberty on Sislet Street, and I had to take a streetcar to go from where we lived to Fifth Avenue High School. And that was about the end of 1917 and 1918. The flu year, 1918 too, and we had to take the streetcars, and the streetcars were cold, and it was a very cold year, so I remember it. Maybe I got the flu, but I didn't admit it. And, they closed down the schools. They closed down Peabody High School in 1918. I went to work to help my father in the fruit business. We were selling a lot of lemons. That was the only cure for the flu that was known at the time. I remember that. I graduated from Peabody High School, and I got a medal from Rensselaer Institute, gold medal, for being the highest student in the high school, math and science. Now, as I said, I didn't know that I was dumb, and I didn't know that doing a little more work would hurt me. So I took as much work as I could, as it was time for. They didn't tell me that I could only have so many courses. And my son graduated from Gateway High School in 50 years after I graduated from Peabody. And I had a tremendously better education than he ever had. I don't think he got the kind of education I got in high school at Gateway plus Harvard. In mathematics, I had geometry and algebra and solid geometry and advanced algebra and trigonometry. I took musical appreciation. I even had a course in musical composition. That's what they taught then. I had German, I had Latin, and all kinds of English courses.
All this in high school?
All this in high school. We had, at Peabody, we had 5 Latin teachers, and they were all good scholars, good teachers. They knew Latin. And all this was in high school at the time. Now you can see to what extent the educational system has deteriorated. My son didn't have anything like that. He couldn't, there was no Latin. The German was sort of, I don't know. My daughter had chemistry, and what was happening was the baseball coach was reading the chemistry out of a textbook. So I got through high school, and I went to Carnegie Tech. My father was a type that didn't believe much in letting me go away. He said, "Du wirst lernen zu lernen da. Du wirst nicht come to work." So I went to Peabody Carnegie Tech. I took the physics course. At that time, I was the only student who took the physics course, and there was one more student who was out of the class. I was a class of 24. He was out of the class of 23, and he had flunked, so he took the course with me. So there were just two of us, and there was one chemistry student. Again, I took as much work as I could. Not only did I take the regular physics course, but I took the music course. I played violin. I took violin over there, and we had orchestra and ensemble, and I went through that. I graduated from Carnegie Tech in 1924, and I was the second highest in the class. Here's an article. Do you want to look at that? Both that girl and I came from Peabody High School.
Then your courses were mostly scientific, the chemistry and the physics.
Well, Carnegie Tech had a good set of courses. Not only did I take scientific, I took a lot of courses over to art school. I was taking extra work and a lot of course, and at least one course over at Margaret Morrison. We had a good economics course. The fellow who taught us economics was Leon Henderson. He was afterwards the food administrator during World War II, and he was a good he was a good teacher. He was very knowledgeable, and we learned a lot. We had public health, of course. We got the usual course on venereal diseases, and. But a lot of other stuff. We had a very good teacher. His name was Rush on public health. So it wasn't all completely scientific. I took advanced theme writing at the art school, and scientific German and scientific French. That's what they called it, but it was a good course in German. In fact, I can still read German very well, and I can read French, but not as well as I can German. I finished up there. I don't know whether you want to see this or not.
What was your idea as far as what you were going to do professionally with your education from CMU? Did you have any idea?
I was going to be a physicist.
I see. Then what happened at graduation?
Well, I graduated, and I had a scholarship, but you didn't have to be an athlete in those days to get a scholarship. I got a scholarship to the Harvard Graduate School. And I went there and took physics. That photograph below there is my roommate in the third year. His name is Morris Marden, and he was a very highly regarded student at Harvard. I think he finished the undergraduate course in 2 years. And then he went under what they call a Sheldon Scholarship to study in Europe. And when he got back, he couldn't get a job because he was Jewish. He wanted a job as a teacher. He couldn't get a job as because he was Jewish. And he told me that there was a Professor Osgood at Harvard who... like me too, but he was a mathematics professor, and he got up at a meeting and pleaded for a job for Morris Marden, who had a doctor's degree out of Harvard in math and quite a background. But it took some time, and finally Morris Marden got a job in a school up in Milwaukee, which ultimately became University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and he has the rank of distinguished professor of mathematics up there. It wasn't a matter of merit, you know. If you were Jewish, that was it. Well, when I got out of Harvard, I also had difficulty getting a job. But there was a fellow who had worked at Harvard, who had gone to Harvard and worked for Westinghouse, who was highly regarded at Westinghouse. His name was Joe Slepian. And Osgood had introduced me to Joe Slepian when Joe was up there to give some kind of a talk. Osgood knew the problems that Jewish people were having. For example, you couldn't get into Bell Labs at all. No chance. As a matter of fact, there was no chance in the industry anywhere. And the colleges wouldn't take Jewish graduates either. So he introduced me to Joe Slepian, and when I came back to Pittsburgh and sat around for a while trying to get a job in a college, I finally got the idea of calling Joe, and he sent me over to Westinghouse to be interviewed. And so they interviewed me, and I talked to him, and he was at the research lab, which was then the only lab they had was that building up on the hill on, what's the name of that street that goes down there?
Internal Creek? No.
Well, the road that goes from Wilkinsburg into East Pittsburgh. Can't think of that. It was up on the hill, and he was there. And I went home from the interview, and the next day I got a letter and said they weren't hiring people at that time. So as a matter of courtesy, I called Joe and told him that I got that letter. Well, the next day I got a call from the man who had interviewed me at employment, and he was scared. and he said he had a job for me. What I imagine happened was that Asclepian, who had considerable influence there, just about tore him apart. So the job was in the radio department, which at that time, the way the radio field was set up, you know, it only started, this was in 1928, it had only started about 1920 when Westinghouse engineer, and I can't remember his name, broadcast from his garage. About 1920 this was, or it was a little earlier than 1920, and the Post Gazette, it wasn't the Post Gazette, it was the Gazette Times at that time. The Gazette Times wanted to broadcast the Harding election, the Harding-Cox election. And so they set up a radio broadcasting station in the old K building in East Pittsburgh, and a vice president whose name was H.P. Davis, and who gets credit for the start of the radio broadcasting, said, told this engineer, and I wish I could remember his name, after the election it's coming down. You can broadcast the election. We're being paid for that by the at that time. But after the election, it's coming down, and they broadcast and never did come down. It became KDKA. They started to make radio sets, and the way they operated was that the Westinghouse and General Electric were the manufacturers of the radio sets. RCA was only a selling agency. And what they used to do was make up a model and take it down to Van Cortlandt Park in New York for RCA to look at it. RCA liked it. Then they would order so many, it would be made 60% at General Electric and 40% at Westinghouse. But now, when I was employed, they employed me as a mechanical engineer in the talking movie department. Talking movies were coming in at that time. And that's what I was employed in May of 1928, and started to work on talking movies. Now, because the movies took an amplifier, the movie was also part of the Radio Corporation deal. So I went to work there, and I had to design machines and work in other areas. The whole thing was in its infancy, and we coordinated the design with the engineers from General Electric. I used to go to Schenectady, and they used to come down to East Pittsburgh, and we used to work on the design of these machines. My particular area was a home talking movie machine. And we had a vice president whose name was H.P. Davis, and he was the kind of fellow that would say, well, by November the 17th, 1929, I've got to have a talking movie machine, a home talking movie machine. And I remember working all night to try to make one of those things work. On several occasions. You didn't get overtime that for working all night. About 1929 or around there, the RCA, let me say this. When it came to radio sets, there was something called the Super Heterodyne, on which Westinghouse and GE had the patent control. So the independents couldn't sell a Super Heterodyne set. There were independents like Majestic and Zenith and some others, Air King. They couldn't sell a radio set with a Super Heterodyne circuit in it. So what they did, they went out and they hired Professor Louis Hazeltine, who was then a professor at Columbia, to develop them something that would avoid the Super Heterodyne, and he developed the Neutrodyne, which avoided the Super Heterodyne patents. And the independents started doing very well. They were selling better sets than RCA for less money. Now, the way RCA operated, I forgot to say this, when the price of the sets that they would buy from the manufacturers, Westinghouse and General Electric, was set on a cost plus percentage fee basis. This meant, of course, that the more money that Westinghouse and General Electric wasted, the more money they made.